Hi, and welcome to another episode of Restoring the Soul. I'm your host, Michael John Cusick, and today I am welcoming the extraordinarily gifted Rob Mathis, a true maestro who has woven his life around the threads of music, working with legends across genres, from classical to hip-hop, transforming the sacred into secular song. Rob's annual Christmas concert, celebrating its 30th anniversary this weekend, has been a melting pot of musical styles that captures the essence of his spiritual journey through soulful melodies and collaborations with icons like Vanessa Williams, Michael McDonald, the saxophone player David Sanborn, and even Sting. I am so excited because in 36 hours, I'm going to be in New York City watching Rob and the Rob Mathis Band perform live. This interview was recorded at the 25th anniversary of the Christmas concert, but I've never actually attended live. So I am so thrilled to be able to bring an encore presentation of this podcast. And my conversation with Rob, you'll discover the profound personal significance behind his song, Although It Is the Night. That song is inspired by St. John of the Cross's poem, Dark Night of the Soul. Rob's going to take us behind the scenes of his work with musical giants such as my favorite, Bruce Springsteen, and the incomparable Stevie Wonder. This is more than a conversation. It's a journey through the soulful symphony of life and faith with Rob Mathis as our guide. Rob Mathis, thank you so much for taking time to be on the program today.
It's a pleasure.
You have performed with so many different people and a lot of big names in a lot of different genres of music. You've been an arranger, a composer, a producer, names like Sting and Bono and Bruce Springsteen and Luciano Pavarotti come to mind.
It's pretty eclectic, hasn't it?
Pretty eclectic. Yeah. Yet I heard you say on your video, Beyond the Music, that you would trade all of that if you could not be a songwriter. You'd give up all of that because you just want to write songs. Talk to me about what songwriting means to you.
Well, what I meant to them is that when I was talking to kids at Brigham Young and University of Utah, and what I meant was, you know, a lot of people have asked me when they hear my records, Rob, would you just rather do that, you know, all the time, kind of be a pop star? And when I was in high school, I did think that I was going to be a singer-songwriter and just do that all year round. But music has been such an abiding thing in my life. It's been every moment of every day. I just think and breathe music, that when I, you know, discovered Mahler and Beethoven and Ellington and all this, you know, becoming an arranger and writing a big horn chart on an R&B song, or writing an orchestration for Renee Fleming, the great opera singer, that's what a wonderful thing to be able to do that. And yet I've been able to funnel some funds from that work over the last 20 years into continually making my own records. But I, you know, I had three kids. I married an incredible woman. And it's difficult to be a pop star when you're a family man and you like working in a bunch of different genres and you're busy watering a lot of other people's gardens at the same time. But what I did say to the kids was not, I would give it all up if I could just be a songwriter. Rather, if I knew that in order to work with those great people, I would have to give up songwriting, I wouldn't have done it. Meaning that my work as a writer for myself and as a composer, I've always believed and still believe makes me better for them. When I'm working with Sting and he wants me to solve a problem on a song, or if I'm writing a song with him. I mean, one of the strongest songs off the last Ship record we wrote together, called Practical Arrangement, which Branford Marsalis has since covered. I'm better for him because I've been writing my own music since I was a boy. And if I had to give that up and only be on that treadmill of writing for other people, I would have said no.
You started performing and writing songs very, very young, and you also started touring and had a lot of success early on.
Well, you're kind. I mean, when I was just about 20, I toured with Chuck Mangione, the great jazz flugelhorn player, who's not as well known now, but I mean, he's one of those rare guys who had a huge pop hit with an instrumental.
Feels so good.
Yeah.
And then the 84 Olympic theme song.
Yep. Give It All You Got, I think that was called. Anyway, so that was a nice thing, and I played at the Empire Club in my early 20s on 42nd and Lex. And no, 48th and Lex, and Chris Bode, the trumpet player, was in the band. Andy Snitzer, who's now Paul Simon's main tenor player, was in the band. Mike Davis went on to play with the Rolling Stones. The drummer is now the drummer on the Carole King musical, and played with Hiram Bullock for years. The bass player,
from Letterman,
yeah,
the guitarist,
yeah, and the bass player played from this band at the Empire Club. It eventually played for me when I musically directed Vanessa Williams tours. So it was that was a cauldron of musicality. It was incredible, and I started writing when I was very, very young. My parents are both musicians. Dad's a classically trained clarinetist, but secret Bob Dylan and Beatles fan. And mom teaches Chopin and Beethoven. And so I just got into it very early. I loved it very, very early. And very grateful for it. I mean, I feel like it's all a gift, you know. I mean, music. I mean, to me, I know this sounds sacrilegious, but instead of hearing a fire and brimstone sermon about the fourth chapter of John, sometimes I get closer to God by listening to Mahler's Ninth Symphony. Mm. I mean, that sounds very convenient. It's like, you know, you talk to the Christian community, they're like, well, you gotta be Sunday morning, you should be in church. And I would agree with that. But sometimes for me, listening to Bach gets me closer to the throne room, you know.
So say more about how music touches your soul.
I remember meeting a relative of mine, Tammy, my wife. Her sister's husband has a sister who married a really sweet guy. And I remember trying to talk to him about music at one point. And he's a numbers guy. He's in business. He works at a bank, and he's very successful, and he's a lovely guy. But I had never spoken to anybody less musical in my life. And I think he would admit it. He's like, I don't listen to a lot of music. What do you like? Well, I'm not a big music fan. I mean, and I just couldn't understand it. It was like someone saying they didn't like comedy. They didn't like to laugh or something. Because music for me just seems to... it seems to be the elixir, the fountain. You know, it's always given me my best moments on planet Earth, just being in the midst of good or great music, you know, and it's very difficult to do. You know, I've got a lot of names on my resume, you know, Natalie Cole, Aretha Franklin, Beck, Pavarotti, Lou Reed, Yo-Yo Ma, Renee Fleming, Tony Bennett, whatever, you can go through them. In terms of great music, this, even with those names, in terms of great music I've made, man, I would have to say it's still rare to make really great music. You know, there are some people like Keith Jarrett, the piano player, is a great example. Keith doesn't often make good music. He always makes great music because he's one of the greatest geniuses to ever play the piano. Herbie Hancock, I would say, is the same way. You know, I would say that Springsteen has an ability with words that even in songs not a lot of people know. Like, there was a song off his Wrecking Ball record called Jack of All Trades. You know, just these songs that Bruce might call his B-tracks that are just truer and more honest and more direct and more moving than any, you know, half of what you'll hear anywhere else. So there are certain people that are in touch and making great music all the time. You know, when Sting was writing the Broadway show, The Last Ship, every day he was coming up with new songs where we'd go, you know, I mean, just astonishing. Because he was in that zone. He was in that zone of writing about his childhood and the shipyards and, you know, so, but, in, you know, but I've gone on a lot of sessions, and most of the sessions I've been a part of over the last 20 years have been people making in-tune music, in-rhythm music, very accurately played music, well-written music, but great music. You know, great music, music that transcends the notes.
Say more about that, because that's leading me to ask, what exactly is great music?
Truly great music would be like some of those Keith Jarrett Trio records, Bernstein conducting Mahler's Ninth, Abbey Road, you know, Radiohead in Rainbows is great.
But you're referring to where it all comes together and there's something transcending about it. Say more what you mean by that.
Well, there's a message, there's a collective purpose behind the music. The message isn't overly, you know, hammered at or overwrought, but it's a, you know, you think of the Radiohead record In Rainbows, for instance. It's a very creative band of art school students from Oxford that are smarter than they should be. But they're always searching. They're constantly searching. And there's a lot of despair in that band. You know, I wouldn't necessarily give the record to a lot of my Christian friends necessarily, but as a musician, when I heard it, it was music about possibility and an openness. And I didn't know what was going to happen next. It wasn't verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, out. And it was clearly a band of people wanting to be on the edge of what they could do and continually search out the best and most moving music they could make in their practice genre. You know, it moved me. And when I'm in that zone trying to seek that out, it's the richest and most and best place I can possibly be. You know, working besides staying throughout the last ship was a privilege. I was next to a great creative who's blessed the world with big hit songs, but who also happens to be brilliant and deep and lyrically astonishing. And we were on the path of seeking beauty, transcendence, meaning. And it's just, it's an extraordinary experience.
You know? That sounds incredible.
Yeah.
Who are some of the other folks you've worked with where you've had that kind of an experience?
Well, I always love when I come in contact with people who love music with the passion that I do. And of course, I've been fortunate that most of the people I'm with now are that way. But I still remember Tony Bennett when I came up, and my job with him was to basically map out vocal duets. Like if you sing with Diana Krall or Stevie Wonder, I would help map out the duets. Well, let's have Diana come in here. We have to change the key for her because her voice is a little, you know, but then you come in on the bridge because the melody's lower on the bridge. We can stay in her key. I was kind of the map guy, the vocal duet map guy. And I remember he was talking about Judy Garland, and he found out somehow that I did not own Judy Garland at Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
And he was so sweet about it, but he got a little ticked off. He's like, "Are you kidding me? You know, she's the greatest entertainer that's ever lived, you know? You have to leave here right now. You've got to promise me you're going to go buy that record." And I went out and I got that record. That was a time when there were record stores. This is about 10 years ago. I bought it and listened to it. And it is transcendent. I mean, Judy Garland, for all the travail she went through in her life, I mean, she was a transcendent performer. And Springsteen, I mean, when I went to do the string charts for the Wrecking Ball record, you know.
I just read his Born to Run. Unbelievable.
Oh, he's
book.
Incredible.
His vulnerability, his honesty, his
well,
humility.
We did all this. He was working on a project that was almost Jimmy Webb, Glenn Campbell-like. Almost an Americana project, a road project where he wanted to use some of that Jimmy Webb-like orchestration. And they called me in because I know Jimmy well. I've done string quartet arrangements for Jimmy Webb. I'm going to musically direct a Jimmy Webb concert at Carnegie Hall in a couple months. And so I came in and I did a bunch of arrangements. And then suddenly Bruce started writing in another genre because he was writing about the end of, is it Giant Stadium or the Meadowlands or something, whatever they tore down, which Wrecking Ball's about. And then he started writing about the heartland and what working people were going through and how, you know, this whole hillbilly elegy thing where working people want to think that either the conservatives or the liberals are going to answer their needs, and they're just struggling. They need somewhere to meet them where they live, you know, and he wanted to write to that. And so he wrote this whole record in a matter of weeks.
Wow.
And he was on the road. He had about 40 songs written about something else. And I said, "Bruce, you're incredible. Well, how does that work?" He's like, "Well, sometimes I stick my shovel in the dirt right in front of me, and I'm just, and accidentally I trip, and the shovel goes to the right. And I just start shoveling there." And you could tell the guy wakes up to write and writes all day and thinks all day. And I'm sure it drives Patty and the kids a little batty because he is one of those great creatives. He's one of the God's given us, you know, in the last 40 years of writing. But it's just interesting to be around that. And of course, everybody I've worked with, I think all the great people I've worked with have had that kind of, I mean, Yo-Yo Ma, the first thing I ever wrote for him was an arrangement for the centennial of the Dallas Symphony. And he was coming to play Dvorak's cello concerto, which is the great cello concerto. And Vanessa Williams was on the program, and she loves Harold Arlen. So it was the idea of the Dallas Symphony board for me to write arrangements for Yo-Yo to have like cello obbligato lines in these great Harold Arlen songs. And so I was so daunted. I mean, this was 1999. So I'm a much better orchestrator now. I've written, 500 arrangements since then. But I agonized over it. He came in and he treated it as if it was Dvorak.
Wow.
He brought me into the room and he said, what about this? What if I bow it this way? What do I do this? And he had more energy and more respect and love. And this is a giant. This is a musical giant. And this was a good arrangement, Michael, but this was not Dvorak. And so that kind of love and grace, I find I've been very fortunate. I mean, you do hear about some musicians that can be very, very gifted and very, very difficult. I've been pretty free of that. I mean, I'm sure I've had some run-ins, but...
And we won't ask.
We won't. Those, right, yeah. Right, exactly. But most of it has been just a great blessing, you know?
You mentioned Stevie Wonder a couple of minutes ago, and I was channel surfing, and it was during Obama's inauguration.
Yeah.
And I stopped on the concert, the outdoor concert.
At the Lincoln Memorial.
Lincoln Memorial that you did. And I saw you sitting next to Stevie Wonder on a keyboard. And Stevie was rocking his head back and forth, and you were rocking back and forth. What was that like to direct the inaugurative concert?
My favorite record in pop history is Songs in the Key of Life.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, everyone says Abbey Road or a Stones record or maybe Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home or Highway 61.
Blonde. So, Sir Duke, Isn't She but Lovely?
Isn't She Lovely? As Pastime Paradise... Have a Talk With God, I Wish. I mean, it's just a masterpiece. And Stevie at his best basically transcends his genre completely. I mean, he's just one of the great musicians in the history of pop music, without a shadow of a doubt. He's up there with James Brown and Prince and all these other people. And I've gotten a chance to work with him on a number of occasions in that same kind of music director mode where I'm working on a project with a bunch of different artists and Stevie's come in to play. And I've had to act with Stevie. Let me be honest. I'm not like, hey, Stevie, do this chord, do this. You know, I'm normally the air traffic controller in that situation. And I'll play guitar and I still remember. I will never forget MDing the Pavarotti and Friends benefits a number of years.
Musical director.
Music director.
As opposed to the medical director.
Yeah, exactly.
Giving CPR.
Exactly, yeah. And Stevie came in and did Higher Ground, and he had the end of Higher Ground, he had this like wisdom. It was some phrase that the band could not get. And we had perhaps at that time the greatest drummer in the world playing, Steve Gadd, who drummer will know.
Yeah. Studio guy who's
yeah.
And Steve.
And Steve was convinced it was in 4/4, like it was. And I said, no, Steve, you can't think of it in 4/4. However syncopated it isn't. You just got to hear the phrase. And I was right. And Stevie, you know, yeah, boy, that's it, you know. And he's just a giant. I mean, what do you say? I mean, when I'm in the room with these kind of people, he came saying Fragile with Sting at Sting's 60th. He gets on stage and we all marvel. We just all are grateful we're in the room with him, you know?
When you were a teenager writing songs and performing, did you ever imagine that you'd be working with folks like this?
I had no idea. No, I really did think I was going to be just a singer-songwriter and work on my own music. That's all I ever wanted to do. Anytime I would hear a new genre or a new master, I would want to chase it. And so I would go off on tangents. I would study Mahler's Ninth and transcribe the first movement for my mom and I to play on double piano, forehand, two pianos. And then I would, literally imbibe Songs for Swingin' Lovers, the great Frank Sinatra record just to check out those Nelson Riddle records.
We have a mutual friend that calls that being promiscuous with the genre.
Yes. And it's tricky. It can be said that maybe even most of the greatest artists in human history do practice within a particular language. They expand that language, but they're not trying to be eclectic. I mean, obviously, you look at Peter Gabriel or Paul Simon or Sting, artists who, you know, we can all say have morphed and they've had their different stages of their career. But still, there's that inimitable voice, and they did make it on one genre initially.
Right.
You know, you don't get to Abbey Road and Sgt. Pepper's without She Loves Me. You know, She Loves You, yeah, 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 and I want to hold your hand, you know. And that's been the one, I think, sometimes my weakness is that I'm jumping around too much. But the thing I will say for myself is when I am working within these genres, it's like I know nothing else. I treat it like it is my language. I live there. And I was an iPod kid before an iPod was invented. I mean, in the front room, my dad would be listening to Peter, Paul, Mary, and Dylan. You know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and Bob Dylan. And my mom would be playing Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu and teaching the Beethoven Pathetique Sonata to her kids. And my uncle, who was married to my mother's identical twin sister, was a big band leader. And he was actually a big band writer, not a leader. He played like trombone with a bunch of big bands. And he was the one that said, you've got to listen to these Sinatra records. And my aunt played the New York City Opera. And then I met a bunch of people growing up. My adopted aunt, Jan, was a huge Motown fan. And I still will never forget the first time at 7 years of age that I heard Never Can Say Goodbye sung by Michael Jackson.
Wow.
I mean, it was like a bolt from the blue. I mean, it was a transforming experience. That little kid singing like no one has ever sung since, except maybe Stevie. I was just a genre hopper. I just loved all this different music and followed it. And it led me to being a string arranger for people and a horn arranger for people and a choral arranger for people and an MD. My dad's a band leader. That's what he does. He teaches the band in Greenwich, Connecticut. He teaches band at four schools. He's now retired. But so I knew what it was like to have to corral cats. So that became a lot of my life.
So do you ever struggle being that musical air traffic controller or the guy behind the scenes with the arrangements? I know that you still perform with the Rob Mathis Band, but it sounds like most of what you do is kind of in the shadows of production. Is that hard for you?
You know, it hasn't been because, I mean, as you know, when you work on film or something, it's the director of photography and the director of the film that has a big influence on the outcome. I mean, the Panic at the Disco record, Pretty Odd, their second record, which I produced, I'm really proud of. It's a really energetic, deep record. These kids are discovering the Beach Boys and the Beatles and they want to go there. And we mixed it at Abbey Road and I recorded the strings at Abbey Road and I played harpsichord and piano and guitar on it, but I was a smart enough guy to get out of the way and to let it sound like them and not me. So no, it's all been a gift. You know, I just see it as all. And I'm grateful for it because, you know, we're nomads. We're troubadours. We musicians, we never know where the next gig is coming. You know, I remember going through writing and getting to write a song with Sting, for God's sakes. I mean, my goodness. And then, you know, having no work for about a month, being able to spend time with my family and most of my wise friends and certainly my Christian friends say the right thing. They say, God will provide. He loves you. He's giving you this break to be with your family. You're a husband. You're a father. But I'm assumed I'll never work again. You know, so I'm grateful for all of it. And it's been a privilege to be able to do my own music. As you know, Michael, I've released a record regularly for the past 20 years, and they're really good records.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm really proud of them, especially Evening Train. And its sequel, Wheelbarrow, and of course, William the Angel, which I have. That song has gotten out into the ether. That song I wrote for my
Yeah, Kathy Mattea won a Grammy for it.
Well, Kathy recorded the final song in that little song cycle, which is called William the Angel. She recorded Good News, and she won a Grammy for it, yeah.
The actual song, William
yes.
the Angel.
No, she recorded Good News,
right.
which is the fourth song in the song cycle that's called William the Angel, of which the first song is William the Angel. And that's the song that I got to sing across the country 40 times at the Boston Pops. 1 year we toured that song, and a number of people, you know, if you go online, you type in William the Angel, churches sing that song, and that song's gotten out there. And there are still people that fly out to see my Christmas concert just to hear that song. In fact, the 1 year I didn't do William the Angel, I got in a lot of trouble. I actually got letters and emails, complaints. So I've been able to do my own stuff while having the privilege of dealing with these greats, you know.
Sir, I'd like to move on. trooper says be careful, haven't you got some place to go? William says no, just stay here and wait, while pointing to the remains of his wing. He is offered a ride, but says thank you, no thank you, I'm an angel to a king. And this is what I sing before he returns me to heaven. May he fix my wing, send me to Mexico City or Cape Town. Doesn't matter. There's always hope, I was told. And I'd like to save one soul, just one soul.
Tell me about the Christmas concert. You've collaborated with some big names on that, and that's an annual thing you do for a fundraiser.
In 1993, I had the first record you ever heard me do, Michael. It's called Heart of Hearts, and it was these two song cycles. It's not available now. It's an early record. I don't disown. I mean, I'm very proud of it. It's a very contemporary Christian record. And since then, I've worked in a broader zone. I've tried to be more of a, you know, just a singer-songwriter writing about spiritual and sometimes Christian issues, but not with that moniker on it. Just so the boards are cleared and so people can enter in to this dialogue without having a label on it. Whereas Heart of Hearts was a record I wrote for my church.
And even though you're calling that a very contemporary Christian record, it is musically beyond anything I've ever heard in terms of its breadth and how eclectic it is.
Well, it's rich in classical tradition. There's a brass quintet on there. There's a song called Trouble Today, which has Latin influences. Yeah, so it was musically very, very rich. And it didn't sound like, you know, an Amy Grant record or Stephen Curtis Chapman record.
Right.
As great as those records, a lot of those records are, and Stephen's amazing. But I as is Amy, what a great writer she is. But I never really listened to a lot of that music. I listened to Aretha and Radiohead. And so Heart of Hearts was the first record where I ventured into writing music for the church I was going to at the time, which is St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Darien. And I just always loved Christmas music. I always loved it. All kinds of Christmas music, from carols to Vaughan Williams. And so I wrote these. Oh, wow, look at that. Someone got into a car, Michael, and the car locked in with my phone, and that's why we heard that music. Anyway, so.
Technology.
Yeah. So what was I saying? So I wrote Heart of Hearts for my church, and it was based around issues around Christmas, the birth of innocence coming into the world to transform it. And I always loved Christmas music so much that we just started giving a concert in 1993 at a church on a hill in Greenwich, Connecticut. And because I'd been with Chuck Mangione and Kathy Mattea had won the Grammy for Good News, a bunch of people came to it and they loved it. And we did the whole Heart of Hearts song cycle. And then next year I'd released William the Angel. And so we did all of William the Angel and some of Heart of Hearts. And it became a thing. People loved, you're going to do the Christmas concert this year? So this is now 93, 94, and then finally we went to Purchase College, which is a State University of New York on the Connecticut and New York border, and they have an amazing performing arts center that everyone goes to, Yo-Yo Ma, the New York Philharmonic. It's an amazing place. And I started my career really started taking off. I started working with Phil Ramone and Vanessa Williams and Pavarotti and George Michael and Natalie Cole. And I was working as an assistant and associate producer of sorts with the great Phil Ramone, who basically, if it weren't for Phil, I don't know where I'd be now. I mean, the gift he gave me of bringing me to all these situations. And so the Christmas concert, I started doing arrangements of things in the mode of Ellington and Bob Marley, and I started writing more music, and I put out Evening Train, and the Christmas concert expanded musically. I got a six-piece horn section, and I brought these great gospel singers, James D. Train Williams and Van Nuys Thomas, in. And then when I wrote these Christmas songs for Vanessa Williams, she did the concert, and we invited Michael McDonald from the Doobie Brothers, David Sanborn, the great alto saxophone player, Ossie Davis, who wrote, who read Langston Hughes Christmas poems, and we filmed that. A great guy in Stanford named Mike McCary, who ran a company called Eagle Vision, he loved the concert, and he filmed it, and it went out on PBS. And then the concert really took off, and it became a three-night thing, a three-concert thing. And now we're 24 years later, you know, and it's every year the concert gets deeper and richer. We've got Will Lee from The Letterman Show on bass, Sean Pelton from Saturday Night Live on drums, Joe Bonadio, my longtime collaborator.
I just saw Joe do percussion with Mark Cohn.
Mark Cohn, yeah. Yeah, well, Joe plays with Mark and played with Sting, did The Last Ship with Sting. And all these great people come. And the horn players I talked to you earlier in this interview about, Andy Snitzer from Paul Simon and Mike Davis from the Stones. Don Harris from Nile Rodgers' band plays lead trumpet. And so it's just become this thing where if you're in the New York area around Christmas time and you come to that concert, you're going to hear music making at the very highest level, I think. And I'm not giving myself credit for that. I mean, I do think my arrangement work and my songwriting is strong, but the guys I have up on that stage are just extraordinary. The guys and gals. So, yeah, so that's a focal point of my year.
You talked about faith and spirituality, and though you're no longer associated with contemporary Christian music and you're deeply immersed into all kinds of music around the world, a lot of your songs have deeply spiritual and sometimes explicitly Christian themes. And I want to talk about the song, Though It Is the Night, that you wrote, which is just one of the most moving songs production-wise I've ever heard. And then the lyrics, of course, are based on John of the Cross's poem.
Yes.
Is it Dark Night of the Soul?
Yes, Although It Is the Night.
Talk to me about that song and how you came to write that.
That song, it's amazing about that song. That is the last song on Evening Train, which is the one record I give to people if they ask for one. Because that record is the best combination of the arranger, the writer, the man of faith, but the man who mixes the sacred and the profane. And I think that's such an important part of great music, is the mixing of the gears grinding and the heavens singing, you know, the mix of that. And Although It Is the Night, I wish I could remember, Michael, when I wrote that and what was going on at the time. But it was clear to me when I was making Evening Train, that record, that Although It Is the Night was going to be the kind of the moment we arrive at the end of that journey, the focal point of that record. And I remember I wrote the song as a suite, in a way. It's two songs that are joined together at the end of Evening Train. One is called When I Was a Child, and one is called Although It Is the Night. And what happens in When I Was a Child, I still remember when I was coming back from Berklee College of Music, and I'll try to make this quick because I think I'm going to put you to sleep in a second. But when I was coming back from Berklee College of Music, my mom wanted me to take the train back with my grandfather once. And my grandfather was a man of deep faith, but he was one of these guys who, if you walked by him in a certain mood, he would sit you down on the couch and preach to you for an hour. Oh, Grandpa, I really want to go out and play. Well, no, let me read you from this passage in the Bible. And he was an important part of my life, and I loved him. And he was a train engineer, was poor, grew up fairly poor, a train engineer. And I didn't want to go back from Berklee with him on the train. I really didn't. I said to my mom, please, grandma's just going to talk about God for 3 hours, and you know, I love God, but I don't want to be preached to for 3 hours. I just want to read a book. She said, Robbie, you're going to get on that train and ride with your grandfather. You don't know how long you're going to have your grandfather. So, boy, my mom was wise, because I got on that train with him, and he basically told me about his life. And he didn't preach to me in the way he normally did. He just basically, and then I ended up asking him questions. And there's one moment in when I was a child that still, and this sounds so sappy, Michael, forgive me for this. I mean, this sounds not only sappy, but it sounds self-serving. But there's still one moment I tear up every single time I hear it. And it's in the end verse of When I Was a Child. And when his story was told, and he told me a story about a train wreck, I asked him if he ever thought the heavens were cold. He said, son, to tell you the truth, I've loved my creator since the days of my youth. You know, which is directly out of the Bible. And that moment in that song crystallized for me the dialogue. Like in the song When I Was a Child, I'm bemoaning the fact that as an angry young college kid, I see a very suffering world. I see a suffering world where it would be very easy to see that this is either a watchmaker God who created us, gave us the garden, and then when we messed with it, he said, I'm out. I'm out of here. Now, that's not the experience of people of faith all around the world. You know, you talk to people, you know, I've talked to a woman in Rwanda who is sure that God saved her life for a purpose, and she eventually went off, survived the genocide in Rwanda, and literally changed the world. Mm. So, as a person of faith, I've seen miracles in my life, but I have dear friends and people I love more than life itself who are dyed-in-the-wool agnostics, and I get it.
Yeah.
So when I'm writing When I Was a Child, I'm saying I'm writing with a man who didn't have an easy life and tells me he loves his creator, and he's a man of faith, you know. And then we get to Although It Is the Night, and I wrote Although It Is the Night right after it. And both songs were written about a year before I started recording Evening Train. Evening Train was written right before we started recording the record. And that's also, that's a companion song to When I Was a Child. It's dedicated to my grandfather and all about him. But Although It's the Night, I remember reading a Seamus Heaney poem called Station Island. And in the poem, and I may get this slightly wrong, Michael, but what happens in the poem, because I haven't read the poem in literally 15 years, but his teacher, towards the end of the poem, tells him within the narrative structure of the poem to translate a St. John of the Cross poem as an exercise, as a kind of spiritual exercise. And he translates this poem, you know, oh, how well I know that mountain's rushing flow, although it is the night, you know. The whole lyric keeps coming back to although it is the night, although it is the night. And to me, what a great idea that is, that no matter what you're going through, full well I know that fountain's rushing flow, although it is the night. And I didn't want to use Heaney's translation because, you know, I'm sure it was under copyright and stuff, but I knew this was an ancient poem. Not ancient, but I knew it was from a while ago. So I looked up a bunch of different translations and kind of matched them and then put my own lyrics in between. And that's Although It Is the Night. And we were scheduled to mix that song on 9/12/01.
Wow. I get chills because I get chills every time I listen to that song.
But well, I think it's as good as I've got in me. I really do. I think that's, you know, there are a couple songs. Williams one. I really love playing Evening Train, even though it's more of a blues. It's, you know, but Although It Is the Night,
I heard a story, Rob, where you performed that song, perhaps it was at the Christmas concert in December after 9/11, 3 months after. What was that like?
Well, it's interesting. I had taken the year before off because I toured with the Boston Pops, sang William the Angel all over the country, and people were so moved by it. It was such a great experience. And it was the only year I took off in the last 24 years of a Christmas concert. We took newspaper ads out and said, we thank the audience for being there, but Rob's been asked to go on tour with the Boston Pops, you know, and sing his own songs. You know, 01, we were back. So it had been 2 years since a Rob Mathis Christmas concert. And now, you know, the Christmas concert has expanded. There's a rabbi that comes to the Christmas concert every year that is just, you know, and I'll circle on back to that 01 experience, but I bring this up. Rabbi Mark Golub has come now every year because he just loves the music. And I said, Rabbi, you've got to teach me about the Maccabees because you're now coming, you're the biggest fan of my concert out there. I want to write a song for you. And he sat me down for 5 hours and taught me everything about the Maccabees. And I was determined not to write a cute Hanukkah song. So I've now written a series of deep, you know, really rich and moving Hanukkah songs for the rabbi. But back in 01, the concert was still almost like a midnight mass for some people, you know. And I mean midnight mass in a universal sense, Protestant and Catholic. You know, we always had it right before Christmas. Like, we almost wanted to do the concert on Christmas Eve because the feeling was like, that, you know, the creche is about to be filled with the baby. And that 01 year, I did, because we were releasing Evening Train, I did When I Was a Child. Into Although It Is the Night. And you could just feel it because you see these planes go into these buildings and a war starts and our world has not been the same since. And it was a tough time to say, full well I know that fountain's rushing flow, although it is the night. The agnostics felt very justified around that time. Where is God in all this? And of course, a lot of us who'd grown up in faith were despairing, you know, and we understood it was it's a world history of darkness, incredible darkness. But it was very moving. You could tell people in tears, and it was the perfect song for that time in a way.
How will I know that fountains are rushing? Fountains are rushing flow, although it is the night. Its spring is hidden, even so. I guess from whence its sources flow. Its origin no one knows, but that all origin from bitter rose, although it is the night, although it is the night, and I can't make heads or tails of anything in front or behind me, the night. We'll be right back. that fountain's rushing flow. Although it is the night, although it is the night, although it is the night, although it is the
So, Rob, I want to talk about another song, and these are the only songs I'll ask you to comment or exegete on, but it's a song kind of in the opposite direction from Although It Is the Night, and it's the song Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral. And that's kind of a song that's like a punch in the face, and yet there's this almost Beatlesque sweet melody. And so to me, it's a song of contradictions. Tell me about that. What was going on that you wrote that song?
Well, Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral is off a record which was kind of my rebellion record in a way. It was called Flesh and Spirit. And I really wanted to poke at some elements of my history as a person of faith and a person who spent most Sundays in church. I wanted to just poke a few holes in things that had bothered me for a long time. And I'm sure we all feel this. Most Christians would agree with me on the fact that people that say they're Christians sometimes say the most heinous things, you know, things that couldn't possibly relate to any gospel anywhere that would help anybody. You know, if we don't watch ourselves, it becomes kind of a club for those, you know, check these things off. Do you believe A? Do you believe B? Do you believe C? Do you believe D? Do you believe E? Do you live your life in this way? Do you behave in this way? Okay, you get in. You're in the club. And, you know, we heard about all these abuses within the Catholic Church and these crazy things in the Christian Church, like the Westboro Baptist and all this mad stuff. And, you know, I just thought to myself years ago, this was a title I had in my head for about 10 years. Man, if Christ came back and walked among us, he would probably be pretty ticked off. And I had the phrase, Christ came back and trashed the cathedral. And I never did anything about the phrase because I thought, you know, anytime you try to write a political song or try to make a big statement and you're not Lou Reed or David Byrne or Dylan with that kind of a gift, you're really treading on difficult water. People don't want to be preached to. People want to hear your story. If you've got a story you can tell musically in a compelling manner, people want to hear that. But they don't want to hear you preaching to them. They really don't. And so I sat on the title for a long, long time. And then when I started writing most of the songs that are on Wheelbarrow, which has a couple of my, you know, songs almost as strong as Although It Is the Night, one of which is called Consider It Joy, which was written in the wake of coming back from Rwanda with Ian Cron, our mutual friend. When I started writing songs for Wheelbarrow, I finally came up with a lyric that made Christ Came Back, Trashed the Cathedral work. But here's the interesting thing. Wheelbarrow was a sequel to Evening Train. I was playing piano a lot of the time. There were horn arrangements. And I wrote a funky version of Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral. And then when I was starting to prep Wheelbarrow, I left it off. Something was wrong. It had some really cool chords in it. At times, it almost reminded you of Steely Dan or something. And I rekindled my relationship with Joe Bonadio, this great drummer, this scruffy drummer, almost like Animal from the Muppets, who will, you know, bring a frying pan and play the whole track on frying pan if he can. You know, he collects, you know, junkyard stuff and plays on it. He's one of those guys. He's just amazing. And I called Joe up one night and I said, listen, I've got a lot of these songs I'm working on. There's this great Nobel laureate named Leo Xabo who read St. Paul's writing in prison in China. He was a dissident and he He declared after reading, I don't think he converted to Christianity, but after reading St. Paul's writings, he declared, I have no enemies and no hatred.
So this is where Shoes is from.
This is where Shoes came from.
Song.
And I wrote Shoes based on reading Igzabo's writings. And I think that's how to pronounce his name, Leo Igzabo, I think. And so I started writing this series of songs, and I knew I was going to do it with Joe. I said, Joe, let's just go do a record where it's mostly written on the guitar. It's mostly a guitar-centered project.
Yeah.
I'm just going to bring a bunch of open-tune guitars, and let's do it live. No overdubs, all live. I said, Joe, I wrote this song. And it was really cool. The track is really cool. It had all these interesting chords on it called Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral. But to me, the music sounds too urbane. It sounds too Manhattan, downtown Manhattan. It's like here's a rich C minor 11 chord and a B triad over an A7 going to an A flat major 7 with a sharp 11. It was like it sounded like it was written by a Berklee College of Music kid. And I said, it's this ferocious Christ came back, trash the cathedral. You know, it's this ferocious thing. He said, well, why don't you rewrite it? So I rewrote it on an opened dad-gad tuning, which is what most guitarists out there would know. It's from the bottom string up, it's D-A-D-G-A-D, dad-gad. And I wrote this ferocious version of it, and it worked. And it got the tenor of the music. And then Bonadio came and played, you know, Muppet drums on top of it, and I had the great bass player Zev Katz, who had played for me at the Kennedy Center Honors. I MD'd the Kennedy Center Honors for 12 years, and he was my bass player.
And you won an Emmy for that.
I did.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The one thing I tell very religious people about Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral is it's not a song that just tears down. I mean, it's the song at the end says, you know, maybe one day we'll have a clean altar, a humble altar, and Christ will come back and someone will be blessed at an altar that's been created out of the ruin, so to speak.
Yeah. As you're singing that, it's easy to hear, though, that there's some anger. You're singing out of real intensity.
Yeah. I just, you know, I do think... And I don't want to preach to your audience either, but I do think there are dangerous things that happen sometimes in the Christian world. And I have a lot of dear friends, people that have treated me with such great respect and love that are very conservative politically and very faithful, go to church every Sunday. But sometimes the marriage of a certain kind of ferocious capitalism with the gospel of Christ just seems to me to be a non sequitur at times. So I don't want to overstate that, but there have been times when the behavior of some within the spiritual community has confused me. And then obviously there's the pedophilia in the Catholic Church, which is horrific.
Which is one of the lyrics in the song.
Which is one of the lyrics in the song. So it's all that kind of behavior that just doesn't relate to Christ at all. I mean, sometimes I say to my conservative friends, I say, you got to understand why I've become a card-carrying liberal. And I, you know, it's because I've read Dickens and I've read the New Testament. And I do believe, you know, I was raised by trickle-down economics people. I was raised as a capitalist. But I do believe what Dickens says. We should be known for how we take care of the poor. And as you know very well, Michael, there are some... A lot of the heroes of the conservative community are within the Christian community. I mean, I know Christians that are ferociously conservative and tithe 90% of their income, put their money where their mouth is, and vote conservative because they want to have control over their income. They don't want to, you know, and that they then take that income and they're the true trickle down. They do heal the world. I know you know many of them, Michael, and I know many of them. So I really don't want to harp on this, but Christ Came Back and Trashed the Cathedral really just in a somewhat angry way talks about Christ coming back and calling the play and just saying, throwing a flag down and going, no. Do not show up and picket a funeral in my name or, you know, no, you cannot do these things in my name. I'm done and I'm trashing the cathedral. We got to start all over again. So that's where that song comes from.
As we wrap up, I want to ask you, can you come back to this idea of the sacred and the profane needing to be together? That sounds like a rich idea.
Oh, man. And of course, it's interesting. People like Prince, their whole career is based on that in a way. And I know there are many Christians that would think Prince Prince was Jehovah's Witness, and Prince is one of the greatest musicians to ever pick up a guitar or play a piano, and he's a hero of mine. But I think that the sacred and the profane, I was down in Nashville. Steve Rice is a really great Christian man in Nashville, loved William the Angel, loved a lot of my music, and he said, I want to sign you a deal to do a deal as a writer for EMI Christian Music. And I said, Steve, are you sure? I'm a scrappy kind of liberal New York kid. I get in trouble more often than not. And yes, I've written praise and worship songs for my church, but they were written for my friend and hero and the amazing man, Ian Cron. You know, Ian Cron started a church. And, the idea of the church was this is a church for the rest of us. This is your church where the doubters can come in, not unlike the early Willow Creek, where bring your questions. Come on in. Let's try to meet God. And for the disenfranchised Catholics and the people that kind of got exhausted by the evangelical tradition, come on in. Let's have a dialogue. Let's not just sleep late on Sunday morning, And so I did write praise and worship songs for Ian, normally based on old texts. An old, the old hymn tradition. But I was a scrappy guy. I didn't think Steve was making a good decision at all. But no, he did. He signed me up, and I wrote, and I had an incredible time in Nashville for 8 years. And one of the reasons I stopped writing a lot of, just specifically, spiritual music is because I think the intensity of the consonants, of always having to end in consonants, can weaken a music. And sometimes the questions have to live. There's a dangerous song on Flesh and Spirit called Paint the Windows Black. And it was actually written more from a response to Scientology than anything else. But it goes for any faith tradition which says, come on in, close the door, paint the windows black. We got the truth. We own the truth. Mm. Right? So the sacred mixing with the profane, dissonance and consonance. I wrote a really sexy song for my wife on Flesh and Spirit. My baby still does me. I just think, the spend some time with a fat man is one of the songs on Evening Train.
That song has been unbelievable for me personally. that whole idea of I'll do it tomorrow.
I'll
pull the sword from the stone. Tell me about that song.
Well, come tomorrow. What is it?
I got a lot of plans. Here we go. Keep going.
Tomorrow. I got a lot of plans. Come tomorrow. I'll change my world. And it's basically the whole song is, come tomorrow, I'll fix myself, I'll lose all that weight, and become, worthy of you. But then finally in the chorus, I say, but tonight, this eternal night, which seems to last forever, if you would, if you please, if you can, spend some time with a fat man, And my wife said yes. She's now spent 28 dating with a fat man. Now I'm actually, Michael, you were kind.
You look great.
I have lost 20 pounds, but yeah.
Anyway. And here in your office, there's a treadmill and weights. And
so, but you wouldn't think that Fat Man would be written by a Christian because it's kind of a sexy song, are you asking someone to have premarital sex with you with that song? It's like, to relax. We're mixing the sacred, the profane, the sex. It's a history of music. And listen to Hendrix and Dylan and the Beatles. Rock and roll was, they're burning records. Christian churches were burning some of the best records ever made in the 50s,
Why do you think that Christians in particular just look at the profane and not the sacred? Because what you're saying, and I've seen this for years, I used to write for the Mars Hill Review, where we looked at how the sacred is revealed in secular art and literature and music. Why do we miss that?
I don't know. And I think probably it's for people like you, Michael, wiser than me to figure it out. I do think when I've gone down occasionally, I still get invited to Capo Beach Calvary Church in Orange County, California. They still invite me every 4 or 5 years. They still invite scrappy, radical, liberal, sitting on the fence at times, Rob Mathis, to lead Easter worship once every 3 or 4 years. And I go. they're some of the sweetest and greatest people I know in my life. Craig Whitaker runs that church, and I, you know, Craig is just the salt of the earth. Anyway, why am I bringing this up? Because I know people that in the straight evangelical tradition became what would be scoffed at in the New York art circles, a born-again Christian. And I'm making the quote signs with my fingers. And I've seen the reaction of a lot of those people who have come out of a real drug addiction or real struggles in their life and having a ferocious response to a faith tradition literally saves their life. And they come into it and they want to shut out the profane completely because they were burned by it in their own life. And I get that. So to let off the hook this idea of the Christian prude and the Christian who has no soul and he's just saying, you shouldn't do that. You know, listen, there are Christians down through history that had a good heart and still, you know, caused Somerset Maugham to respond with some pretty, you know, damning fiction about, you know, Christians and curates and who beat, you know, the club over people to, you know, never have sex, never do anything, you know, never drink a drop of wine, that whole thing. I get it. Sometimes the response, you come into the throne room, your life is saved and you just want to hang out there. You know, so the profane is scary. I come back to the music. I come back to the art. All I know is that the work of Thom Yorke and Jimi Hendrix and Lou Reed, who is a heroin addict, and David Bowie and Johann Sebastian Bach, Gustav Mahler, Matisse, Gerhard Richter, the great modern painter, Lenny Bruce. These people have made my life inexorably richer. And many of them are not only not Christian, they are, you know, sometimes fierce agnostics, but their work speaks of the heavens and of something we still don't understand. You know, we Christians assume we understand it, but this miracle of consciousness, you know, what scientists and philosophers would say, the hard problem, that somehow, however the miracle that we got here, someone wrote those late Beethoven string quartets. I mean, my goodness, you know? And I just think letting the art be completely open and nothing be kept out because it's not consonant enough or not worthy of the church, kept out of the music, hampers the music, hampers the art.
Who's on your bucket list to work with, and what would you like to do musically as you look into the future?
Wow. I have been really moved by some of the work within the hip-hop community. I really have, and I'm a, you know, I mean, I grew up on black music. I grew up on African-American music, gospel music. And so I feel like, you know, I worked with this great producer, Just Blaze, and did some stuff for the American Gangster Jay-Z thing. I worked with a couple of, I actually did a string chart for a Biggie Smalls and Tupac collaboration. And every single time I did a string chart for a hip-hop project, they turned it up really loud. Because the attitude of that music is not too many parts, a drum groove, a ton of great vocals, the story on top, the rapping, and the tale telling on top. And if we're going to do a string chart or a horn chart, turn that stuff up. And some incredible music is being made in that community. Now, I know that there are Christian rappers and religious rappers, and I know that a lot of religious people, Christian people, would think that some hip-hop is like dangerous and odd, but there's some great art being made there, and I would like to work with some members of that community. I would love to write, you know, I wrote this cantata about 4 years ago that Ian commissioned me to write with this poet named Michal Oshiel. And it draws the Psalms together with responses from the poet in between Psalms. And it's one of the best things I've ever done in my life. And I really want to revise it and have it released in choral music and have more church people hear it. Because it's actually something you could have in a Sunday service. But it's really, it's written for orchestra and choir and boys choir and it's real. So I want that to see the light of day. You know, I've been pretty fortunate in terms of the stars I've been able to work with. I mean, I really have. I never worked with Paul McCartney closely. I met him and I ran the tribute to him at the Kennedy Center Honors. So I guess I would be honored to write a string chart for Paul McCartney or play keyboards in his band for a second, but he's got a pretty great band. He doesn't need me. I would love to do more for Bruce. My stuff for Bruce Springsteen has mostly been taking string ideas that he's done and completely fleshing them out, where they become my charts, but they're basically based on Bruce's ideas, because Bruce kind of drives everything in his music. But I think his music has a ferocity where we could do, not a symphonicities, you know, I did that symphonic record with Sting. Not necessarily something like that, because that's not Bruce's thing. Bruce is really kind of our folk troubadour poet. But something with like a big brass section and strings, and he brought some of my charts out, and another string arranger has worked with him on some stuff where I think he had strings at the Meadowlands last year, but I think it could be done in a much deeper way. And he's such a giant, man. He's such a giant. I think it would be great to do more with him. I just want to keep making music, and I pray that I'll be able to continue to write my own music and to see people like you respond to Although It Is the Night and William the Angel and Wheelbarrow. And you know, this stuff means a lot to me, because that's really the work that matters more than anything. And I pay for it with the music that makes me my mortgage, which is watering other people's gardens, which is a gift, you know.
Maestro Rob Mathis, means a lot to me that you've taken time. So thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
So thank you for listening to another episode of Restoring the Soul. We want you to know that Restoring the Soul is so much more than a podcast. What we're all about is helping couples and individuals get unstuck. You know how some people go to counseling or marriage therapy for months or even years and never really get anywhere? Our intensive programs help clients get unstuck in as little as 2 weeks. To learn more, visit RestoringTheSoul.com. That's RestoringTheSoul.com.